This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The Olympic Games officially open Friday in Rio de Janeiro, where the theme is Live Your Passion. However, much of the attention has not focused on the athletes, but on health problems.
That's VOA's Jody Kapawa reporting. Details coming up.
Also, according to the UN Human Rights Chief, widespread sexual violence occurred in South Sudan's capital during last month's fighting. And in Libya, U.S. drone strikes are aiding in the offensive against Islamic State terrorists in Central Sirte.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour: in Nigeria, the ousted leader of Boko Haram has denounced the new leader of the militant group and claims he's still in charge. Abubakar Shekau broke 3 months of media silence to say that Tuesday's Islamic State video announcing that Abu Musab al-Banawi is the new head of the insurgency is an attempted coup. Shekau dismissed Banawi as an infidel. Observers of Boko Haram's 7-year insurgency say a rivalry between Shekau and Banawi could further weaken the terrorist group.
The UN Human Rights Chief says there was widespread sexual violence in South Sudan's capital during last month's fighting. Zaid Rad al-Hussein says there were 217 documented cases of sexual violence in Juba between July 8th and July 25th. It appears that displaced ethnic Nuer women were targeted the most. Zaid also says at least 73 civilians were killed in the violence. The Associated Press recently reported that government soldiers raped or gang-raped dozens of women and girls outside the UN camp in Juba. In addition, UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Stephen O'Brien, ended a 3-day visit to South Sudan yesterday. He says he is outraged by the heinous acts of violence that have been committed against civilians. O'Brien describes the humanitarian situation in South Sudan as catastrophic, with more than 6 million people in need of assistance. The UN official says his visit to Wau and Awel was heart-wrenching, with women and children struggling to survive each day.
The Olympic Games officially open tomorrow in Rio de Janeiro, where the theme is Live Your Passion. However, much of the attention has not focused on the athletes, but on health concerns. The threat from the Zika virus has topped the list, but pollution also poses a risk. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Athletes train long and hard to compete in the Olympics. They know who their toughest competitors are and what it will take to win a medal. What they don't know is how much of a health risk they face in the Brazilian city. It's usually not something to worry about at the modern games. Among those monitoring conditions in Rio is Dr. Stephen Gluckman. He's a professor of infectious diseases and medical director at Penn Global Medicine, part of the University of Pennsylvania health system. He says Zika, like other diseases, has raised fear among many people.
There have been certainly other epidemic diseases that have generated an incredible amount of angst, even going back to our region, Legionnaire's disease in the 70s, and then HIV, obviously, generated angst well beyond the medical implications in terms of contagiousness early on. Oh, Ebola, too, I think, got a lot of people's attention for fear of what it represented for spreading beyond where it was.
What's unique about Zika, he says, is that it's become part of the Olympic story this year. People are traveling to where the disease is.
More often than not, people are trying to go the other way.
So how dangerous is Zika? Dr. Gluckman says
about 80% of people have no symptoms at all. And then the people that get symptoms, the symptoms themselves are really expected to be quite mild. It's a relatively unpleasant 5 to 7 day illness, but nothing of significance.
However, one of the possible complications from Zika infection is Guillain-Barré syndrome. It attacks the nervous system and can cause partial paralysis. But Gluckman says that's not the complication that has caused the most fear.
What makes this a particularly volatile problem is this pregnancy connection. When women are pregnant, they're anxious about outcomes, always. It's just normal. Well, the husbands are too.
Microcephaly can cause abnormally small heads in infants, but Zika can lead to many other physical and developmental problems. But while this may happen to a relatively small number of babies, its impact has been huge. He says what's been lost in the controversy over Zika has been possible infection by other diseases carried by the same Aedes aegypti mosquito, namely chikungunya and dengue.
Chikungunya is a much bigger risk overall than Zika, and it spread like wildfire in the Caribbean, but most of my patients have never heard of it. It's because of the lack of this pregnancy association. Several million people that have gotten chikungunya in the Caribbean. It's amazing how few people have heard of it. Dengue is also throughout there. It's much less common, but it's potentially to be the most severe of all of the diseases. People can die of dengue. You wouldn't die of chikungunya, and certainly you don't die of Zika.
Dr. Gluckman says individuals in Rio and elsewhere can do a lot to prevent a mosquito bite, which in the case of the Aedes aegypti happens during the day.
People should be applying a good insect repellent. That would be either 25% to 30% DEET. DEET's the active ingredient in a number of them, or 20% picardin. That's the other active chemical. In addition, long sleeves and long pants. One can spray one's clothes with an insecticide called permethrin. That's sort of almost like magic. You spray it on, and it lasts multiple weeks through multiple washings.
But the infectious disease expert says the biggest health risk in Rio comes from pollution, raw sewage. Human waste from millions of Rio's residents flows directly into the waters off the city's beautiful beaches, and lots of athletes will be swimming in or sailing or rowing on that water.
Stay out of the water. I mean, you got to be nuts. And I wasn't kidding. It's a way bigger potential health risk than Zika, although it won't lead to fetal malformations. But you're much more likely to get sick from the water than you are from a mosquito bite down there.
According to tests conducted by the Associated Press, athletes who swallow just 3 teaspoons of polluted water are almost certain to be infected with viruses. These can and have caused intestinal and breathing problems.
Apparently, this water is particularly loaded with a virus called adenovirus. But you can get E. coli infections, you can get typhoid fever. Anything that people have in their feces can get into the water there.
Depending on what germs a person swallows, it can take anywhere from 3 days to 2 weeks to show symptoms. Dehydration is one of the major problems these bacteria and viruses can cause. Dr. Gluckman says being in great shape, as Olympic athletes are, will not protect them from mosquito bites or swallowing sewage. But Rio faces other problems too, including terrorist threats, gang violence, and debt. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Libyan militia commanders say U.S. drone strikes against Islamic State terrorists in central Sirte have aided their offensive. Libyan militias had been pinned down by Islamic State snipers and landmines for several weeks. 2 days of U.S. airstrikes have targeted buildings in the center of Sirte. That's where several hundred Islamic State fighters held out against a 2-month assault by militias. The militias support the UN-backed government of national accord. Officials in Tripoli had requested the U.S. airstrikes, which have included armed drones from Jordan and marine jets.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 15 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. According to the UN Human Rights Chief, widespread sexual violence occurred in South Sudan's capital during last month's fighting. And in Libya, U.S. drone strikes are aiding in the offensive against Islamic State terrorists in Central Sirte. As well as the Olympic Games officially open tomorrow, much of the attention is focusing on health concerns, especially the threat from the Zika virus. For more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Results from South Africa's municipal elections show the ruling ANC winning a majority of seats, but getting a strong rebuke from voters in major metropolitan areas. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Election results released Thursday show South African voters turning away from the long-dominant African National Congress Party in large numbers and denying them an outright win in major urban areas. The ANC, the party credited with leading South Africa out of apartheid, will continue to hold more local government seats than any other party. But this election has yielded decisive gains by the opposition Democratic Alliance, especially in metropolitan areas like Johannesburg, the economic hub, Pretoria, the capital, and the seaside city of Port Elizabeth. The DA already holds the city of Cape Town and surrounding Western Cape Province. The far-left economic freedom fighters also made gains nationally, but not enough to dominate any major urban areas. Voters said they were dismayed by numerous scandals within the ANC, the corruption allegations that persistently swirl around President Jacob Zuma, and the enduring inequality and unemployment that they feel the ANC has not remedied since it came to power in 1994. Susan Boyson is a professor of governance at the University of the Witwatersrand and author of Dominance and Decline, The ANC in the Time of Zuma. She says this local election could have major effects in the future.
It has huge implications, I think, for governance in South Africa and for party politics. It probably means, in the first place, that the ANC would be necessitated, forced to step back and reflect on how they will be approaching national and provincial elections in 2019.
That's when the nation will return to the polls for national elections. President Zuma's second and final term ends in 2019. In the meantime, the opposition parties will have a chance to show their mettle. But Boyson notes they may still be under the thumb of the ANC.
It is inevitable that there will be coalition governments. In some of these cities where even the ANC and the DA in most of these metro cities remain only the second biggest party after the ANC.
But it is clear the ruling party has been given a wake-up call. And many critics say the ANC's fall from grace can be directly attributable to one man. Perhaps there is no greater example of President Zuma's unpopularity as one small set of results the Election Commission released on Thursday. The president hails from the rural town of Nkandla, where he remodeled a family home using about $20 million in government funds. As of Thursday, the ANC controls Nkandla no more. President Zuma's party soundly lost his hometown to the relatively obscure Inkatha Freedom Party. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
As reported, millions of South Africans voted yesterday in local government elections to choose candidates from political parties to manage services in towns and cities. But some white South Africans from the minority Afrikaner cultural group decided not to vote. They're disillusioned because they say their rights are being ignored. Darren Taylor reports in the fourth part of a series focusing on South Africa's municipal polls.
Afrikaans is the first language of about 7 million South Africans, mostly white and mixed-race citizens. Academic and activist Dan Ruet says some Afrikaners didn't vote because they feel their interests aren't represented.
They see it as a completely meaningless exercise because they're just so outnumbered. Some of them don't even register as voters.
He says many Afrikaners are disillusioned by the few Afrikaans politicians in parliament. But Ruud adds that they're mostly angered by the continued corruption of what he refers to as the elite of the ruling African National Congress, the ANC.
They're also doing business with the municipalities, and a lot of his services and procurement are provided by their cronies to the municipalities. And it's led to the breakdown of a lot of the smaller municipalities, and there are huge problems with water supply and electricity supply and so on.
Over the years, many ANC-linked business people and ANC officials themselves have been charged with stealing money meant for service delivery. Afrikaans has been scrapped as a medium of instruction in several universities. Ruud's pro-Afrikaans action group says the black majority ANC is hostile towards Afrikaans because it's the language of their former white apartheid oppressors and because Afrikaners have a highly developed culture.
66% of South African films are produced in Afrikaans. So that puts all the other people in the country under a lot of pressure to kind of live up to those standards. For them, the easy way out is just to do everything in English and to just watch Hollywood movies or use university textbooks that come from America or the UK.
Other experts say apartheid helped the Afrikaner to build such a strong language and culture. Ruud agrees, but says the ANC shouldn't punish today's Afrikaners for this.
So I think that's another reason why they want to just get rid of Afrikaans, because it relieves them of the kind of moral pressure on themselves to do something about their own cultures that are also going to fall by the wayside as we go along.
The ANC denies targeting Afrikaners and their language and argues that the Constitution protects their rights. For his strong anti-ANC views, Ruud has been branded a racist and even a white supremacist.
Regarding white supremacism, in South Africa, it seems to be applied to anyone who thinks that whites still have a right to play some role in government or in managing affairs in the country. You know, I'm of the view that we should play a role here.
Ruud's critics point to the many Afrikaans business leaders as evidence that his cultural group continues to have a big role in South Africa. He says he's against what he calls the anti-white Afrikaans ideology of many political leaders in South Africa, including politically correct white politicians.
So if rejecting Afrocentrism makes one a white supremacist, then I'm quite proud to be one.
Ruud emphasizes that he's fighting for the rights of all Afrikaans speakers, whatever the color of their skin.
I feel strongly that traditions and identities are valuable and they need to be defended, regardless of whether that makes one a stereotypical nationalist or not. And in today's global world, I think it is important for children to have an identity. My own culture and my language are valuable to me, and we need to have the same rights as everybody else.
He says Afrikaners of all races need self-determination, not necessarily in a separate state, but in some areas of the country that they would administer. The ANC likens this to apartheid, but Ruud insists there are precedents for separatism around the world.
You know, in Canada, the province of Quebec has a large degree of autonomy. Same goes for Belgium, where they've got 7 parliaments for the 3 different language communities and the 3 different regions.
Ruud says if Afrikaners aren't respected and if they don't get a degree of separatism, they'll eventually be forced to leave South Africa, and the extinction of Afrikaner culture will follow. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Turkey is making inroads in Africa and is looking to the continent to help meet its food needs. The government has announced new land leasing deals with some African countries. Nuria Tesson reports from Istanbul.
Africa is rich with fertile lands, and since the 2008 economic crisis, investors have been looking at these lands as profitable business opportunities and as a way to ensure food security for growing populations. Millions of hectares of land find their way into the hands of foreign investors each year. Turkey has been one of the eager ones. Once a leading country in agriculture and livestock, Turkey relies more and more on imports. The government has announced plans to lease farmlands as part of a broader package of economic measures. According to Agriculture Minister Faruk Jelik, the government sees the lease of fertile land abroad as a priority. However, Özden Güngör, chairman of the Turkish Chamber of Agricultural Engineers, says the policy shows a lack of agricultural investment in their own country. He says farmers cannot make enough money raising crops or livestock, so they abandon it and move to bigger cities. Mr. Güngör says that the land that can be used for agriculture is decreasing. 12 or 13 years ago, Turkey used to have around 26.5 million hectares of land for agriculture. Now they have only 23 million hectares of agricultural land. Turkey has lost 3 million hectares of agricultural land. In 2014, the Turkish government signed a 99-year lease with Sudan for agricultural lands. Potatoes, pineapples, canola, cotton, avocados, and other products were supposed to be sold at a cheaper price in Turkey. This was to address a long-term developing solution of potential food scarcities due to rapid population growth. Under the plan, Turkey will also sell products grown in Sudan to the Middle East and African countries. Now, the General Directorate of Agricultural Enterprises has signed a new contract with Sudan to lease 780,000 hectares in the country, and looking for a solution to its need for livestock, Turkey has chosen Djibouti for setting up a livestock facility. Özden Güngör, chairman of the Turkish Chamber of Agricultural Engineers, says there's more Turkey can do at home to improve food supplies. Mr. Güngör says that in Turkey they have enough farmlands for them. They still have fields that are not open for agriculture yet. If they develop some stuff like irrigation, they can have more fields for agriculture. If they support their farmers, they wouldn't need to rent or buy farming lands from Africa. The expert thinks that Turkey is one of those rare countries where you can produce almost any crop. He says the victims of land grabbing are local villagers and farmers in Turkey and Africa. For Voice of America, this is Nuria Tesson in Istanbul.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Zainab Abdulrahman, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical journey. I guarantee.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameyibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.